This podcast is intended for investment professionals only.
Hello and welcome to LGIM Talks and to our first official CIO call of 2024, as we're spacing out the episodes to tackle the biggest market events and themes this year. I'm Max Julius, Head of Content, and I'm delighted to be joined by Sonia Loud, CIO, Emil van den Heiligenberg, Head of Asset Allocation, and Tim Drayson, Head of Economics. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, today we're going to take stock of markets in light of the constantly shifting macro and geopolitical outlook. So with no further ado, I'll pose our first question to you, Sonia, which is that we're just over 3 months through 2024 and many risk assets are already basking in impressive returns. How sustainable do you think this rally is and what could knock it off course?
Thank you very much, Max. And as you said, it's indeed been a very, very impressive start to the year, which is pretty much a continuation where we finished the year. And as you know, before answering whether this can continue and what indeed the main risk factors are, it's always worth taking a step back and understanding what's actually fueling the current support for risk assets. As you know, here at LGIM, prepare, don't predict, because we all have to accept the pitfalls of overconfidence in forecasting. And it seems that there's a lot of confidence currently around in markets with regards to the thesis that is driving the backdrop. Now, we always like to break it down in more measurable input factors. And the first one, of course, is growth, inflation and monetary policy. And I know Tim will address most of these in more detail, because it's the core piece that we need to understand. Secondly, political cycle and the potential influence, again, back on growth, inflation and monetary policy. And we will have loads of this year. As we have discussed prior and in prior episodes, more than half of the global population will go to the polls this year. And of course, it will be all eyes on the US at the end of this year. And last but not least, it's geopolitics, again, with its potential influence on all of the above. So it is, and the reason why I've outlined it this way is because of the interconnectedness. It is worth going step by step in order to understand the individual pieces before you try to piece them all together to understand what's going on. And now, you know, just let's just look at the US, because it is very clear that the US has been enjoying quite a robust macro backdrop. But let's see what consensus currently is assuming. It's steady US growth with falling core inflation until yesterday, and we will come to this in a minute. It was around 3 to 4 rate cuts starting in June, full employment and trend growth afterwards. That's quite the Goldilocks scenario. And again, we will come to the robustness of this narrative in a minute. Now, the importance for investors to understand is what's priced in markets. And here we have quite an unusual setup, because it is quite a narrow path. A lot has to go right for this to all become reality. But what is particularly interesting is that the market seems to be even ahead of what the current underlying data is telling you. If you look at the outperformance of cyclicals versus defensives, it actually has been obviously a great run for cyclicals. But if you compare it, for example, to the manufacturing ISM, markets seem to be ahead and seem to assume already quite a robust improvement in those factors. The second point is that a lot of indices are at all-time highs, earnings are not. So you've had robust multiple expansion on the top of this. And the final factor is that actually equities started rallying prior to the last Fed hike, which is very unusual, because normally equity markets wait for peak rates to be reached. But obviously, we've had the interesting situation last year where this all started. The reason why I'm focusing on this is because a lot has to go right to further sustain what we are seeing here. And I know Tim will, of course, share a bit more of the detail. As I said, current data actually does support a lot of what I've just said, but investors need to balance the market valuation versus the fundamentals and probably understand as well that there is asymmetry in the opportunity set, because of course, not all assets will react equally to any change to that narrow path thesis. So what could go wrong? Ooh, loads. Let's start with yesterday's CPI print, because, of course, stickier inflation will not support the 3-4 rate cuts that was priced in, and it might not start in June. And we have seen quite a harsh reaction in fixed income markets, and this is clearly a first indication of what could go wrong, and equity markets have reacted accordingly. This is even before you then start considering the lagged impact of the rate hike cycle, politics, geopolitics. You see that it is, you have to build one after the other to understand where the risks are coming from. We build scenario analysis around it, and then you will have to consider where the pricing is sit across asset classes, within asset classes, to identify the opportunity set. It is not all doom and gloom. There is opportunities, but I think the asymmetry is the point that I would like to stress the most, because of the positive backdrop that risk assets in particular are clearly telling us are here to stay.
Well, thank you very much for that overview, Sonia. My takeaway is there are prepare, don't predict, and that there's a challenge to the Goldilocks scenario and an asymmetrical opportunity set for investors. That's a great point at which we bring Tim into the conversation to drill down into some of those themes. Well, Tim, after the strong run of US employment and yesterday's CPI print that Sonia's just referenced, is the United States still heading for a soft economic landing?
So that was very much the consensus view at the start of the year. I mean, if you look at the data, you'd have to characterize it as one of no landing thus far. But taking a step back, I should admit I've been completely wrong on the growth outlook. Last year, I was anticipating by now we'd be in recession. If anything, the economy is growing above trend. I thought the 500 basis points of monetary tightening would do some damage. I misjudged the extent of fiscal policy, way more expansionary than anticipated. The excess savings buffer from the household sector helped sustain the consumer. We also had a nice boost to real incomes as the supply shocks from the pandemic reversed. And then there was this big wave of immigration, which has helped rebalance to some extent the US labor market. But once I kind of recognized the error of my ways and abandoned the recession view, I was also thinking that the path that was priced in was narrow, as Sonia had alluded to. It's going to be very hard to sustain such rapid growth and get inflation all the way back down to the 2% target, and then for the Fed to deliver the rate cuts which were priced. Always felt that the last mile was going to prove more challenging, and the last three CPI prints in the US suggest that is the case.
Okay, well, thanks. A clear follow-up question is just actually to touch on something you wrote late last month, which is that the US Federal Reserve appeared unconcerned by inflation. So how do you see the Fed reacting to that inflation setback now?
So I think we will see a hawkish pivot, can I use that word, after the dovish pivot in December, which was another reason why I abandoned the recession call at the time. So the first bad inflation print, they were quite dismissive. They blamed it on residual seasonality. Second one, they took a little bit more seriously, but still had an expectation that inflation was set to moderate. Three bad prints in a row, it's harder to dismiss as a pure bump in the road, to borrow some of the language from Chair Powell. They're now going to have to wait for a few more months of softer inflation numbers in order to feel confident inflation really is trending back towards target. That makes June really too soon. They'll only get the May CPI print on the day of the June FOMC itself. July is still a possibility, and the market's kind of 50-50 right now, but it needs a lot of things to go right over the next 3 months. But if they don't go in July, then we start to run into the election. Politically a bit awkward to be cutting rates just ahead of the November election. So we could well be looking at towards the end of the year before we get a rate cut at all. And for them to deliver that rate cut, I think the trade-offs are now becoming a bit more challenging. So last year it was kind of easy, growth was strong, inflation coming down. Now I think they really do need to see some evidence of a slowdown in the economy, maybe even a little tick up in the unemployment rate. Remember, the markets had rallied in anticipation of the rate cuts. But the Fed might not be able to cut if financial conditions remain this loose. So we have this kind of reverse logic where if we did get some sell-off in risk assets, perhaps that would provide cover for those cuts, but the Fed can't really be preemptive anymore. It's going to have to react to developments, particularly in inflation.
Okay, thanks. Fascinating discussion of those dynamics currently at work in markets right now, and all eyes on CPI going forward, of course. Still, Emil, what does all of this mean for how you're positioning across our multi-asset portfolios?
Yeah, Sonia spoke about overconfidence around the risk of overconfidence of investors, and that's actually key to us. And one way to make money in markets we very much like is to identify areas of excessive confidence. So if you think about the consensus narrative, it's one of reasonable growth, inflation going lower, and interest rates remaining very well behaved. And Tim is noticing to us that, for instance, the spread of individual forecast of individual professional forecasts is actually very, very concentrated if you plot them in a chart of inflation and growth. So that means everyone is in the same boat, and at some point everyone is on the same side of the boat, and then it collapses. So that must mean that narrative of a narrow path going forward in towards Goldilocks, as Sonia and Tim described, is quite vulnerable for a shock. We've been thinking about what could sort of cause that shock. One is sort of upside pressure in inflation, and we saw sort of the first glimpse of that potential risk in the inflation number yesterday. The other one is earnings. Sonia mentioned that as well. And then you have the sort of the geopolitical backdrop. Let's not forget, there are wars going on at the moment. And then we've got sort of very important elections going forward as well. So I think sort of in the absence of fundamental news, the market will continue to go sideways now, because I think the sort of Goldilocks scenario is fully priced. We saw that in the last month. Now you see volatility, but actually sort of we're flat in a month. But then when you get surprises from the narrow path, either too strong inflation, too strong growth, or on the other side, weak growth, that would sort of make the soft landing scenario a bit in doubt. That means we remain short risk because we think that investors will correct on their current optimism. And on the rest of the portfolio, on the fixed income side, the big picture hasn't changed. We still very much believe in long duration, as we think long-term real yields are too high, difficult to maintain this without a growth impact going forward. And within credits, we are underweight credits as we are underweight risk assets, but we like emerging market debt versus corporate debt versus investment grade and high yield.
Great. Well, that's really clear. That's a very striking image there about the investor boat potentially capsizing. Emil, well, look, Sonia mentioned headline index levels being close to or at record highs. I know you're particularly alert to the danger of market bubbles. Why do you think we're not close to bubble-like levels, even when considering the performance of, say, US tech stocks?
Yeah, as you say, the US tech stocks performance has been really strong. They're flat versus the S&P this year, but for last year, they were obviously on a tear, and especially the sort of so-called Magnificent Seven are doing really well. So we get questions from clients as well, increasingly questions from clients as well. Are we in a bubble? And if we are in a bubble, when is that sort of about to burst? And as you say, it's a kind of a long-term hobby of mine to sort of think about these kind of things, and to sort of be able to detect whether we're in a bubble or not. Me and the research team, what we've developed is a LGIM bubble index. And if you sort of plot the latest LGIM bubble index over time, then what you see is that the bubble risks are growing. We are at reasonably high levels, but nothing comparable to bubbles which we've seen in the 90s or we've seen around 2007, 2008. If you think about elements which are contributing to sort of the bubble risk rising, then the first one is obvious, and that's what defines a bubble is valuations. And secondly, there are plenty of people who think and express that thinking in this time is different. I noticed that, for instance, Jamie Dimon, the CEO of JP Morgan, said in a letter to shareholders he is completely convinced, so there's not a lot of doubt in his mind, that artificial intelligence will transform into something which is equal to the printing press or a steam engine. Well, that kind of this time is different or a new era kind of thinking is what you almost always see in a bubble formation. Why is that not a red flag yet? Well, there are plenty of signals here. So for instance, leverage in the system is not yet excessive. We usually see in bubbles signs of deregulation, strong signs of financial engineering. So we all remember CDOs and CDO squares, where the quants of investment banks come up with new products to increase leverage. And that's what we at the moment sort of don't really pick up in markets. So to conclude, the Belgian bubble index hovers around a high level comparable with 97 or 2005 in previous bubbles. There is a setup in place, especially in artificial intelligence, that could feed the narrative into a mania, but that's a possible outcome. It's not necessarily the most likely outcome there. And we think with the bubble index and with our thinking around bubbles, we are well positioned to sort of identify what's going on. But it also means that other macro questions like how the elections are going to drive markets or what's going to happen with inflation remain very relevant. And it also, in our view, means that diversifying your portfolio risk still remains very important.
Thank you, Emil. And I would direct our listeners who are interested in knowing more of your thinking about bubbles to the Elgin blog, where we've got a lot of pieces by you that drill down into the mechanics of that index you referenced. Well, Sonia, do you think markets are correctly discounting all of the political and geopolitical risk they're facing this year? I'm thinking both in terms of upside risks such as fiscal largesse, as well as further tensions across the various fault lines that characterize our increasingly multipolar world.
I think the short answer is no, for the very simple reason that all of the above and all the factors you've just outlined obviously have not been defined yet. And again, I'm coming back to the preparation rather than the prediction, because just looking at the US election, it's very clear that you can consider various outcomes. And with the various outcomes, for example, will potentially come differences in fiscal policy. Now, as Tim has outlined, fiscal policy has been a big supporter of the US macro backdrop last year. And a big question mark is how this will continue prior to the election and post the election. And as such, it will define to some extent the journey forward that I've outlined earlier, because clearly the consensus is for quite a positive growth outlook into the election and afterwards. So this is just one example. Of course, it's not just fiscal policy. There will be a number of focus areas, I would imagine, around immigration, alongside fiscal policy, defense, and of course, the view on the geopolitical side. Now, we are looking at all of these. We are trying to figure out where the candidates stand. We haven't even entered really the campaign trail yet. So I'm pretty sure over the summer we will get a lot more detail. But this is why, for the time being, the market is going with the consensus, which, as we've outlined a number of times, is a very narrow path. And with new incoming information, we will see how the market will price this. I think more in general, we have not seen any discounting of the geopolitical risk, in particular the ongoing very difficult situation and the war zone in Ukraine, and obviously the unresolved situation in the Middle East. The market has not necessarily taken note, other than, of course, we have seen commodities, oil in particular, being more sensitive to specific incidents. But overall, we can say it has not majorly influenced markets. Now, with the backdrop of all the elections, and we know that some expected not necessarily change, but taking a stance towards these. We know the support that particularly the US is providing is incredibly important. So we will have to take note what any change would mean and would imply to the situation that is ongoing. And it just brings me back to the interconnectedness that we have outlined right at the beginning. and the need to break it down to understand what all of this would mean. And clearly, on the inflation side as well, I'm sure the central bank will run their own scenario analysis, what specific outcomes would mean to their own projections. Because as Tim has said, the closer we come to the election, the more difficult the balancing act will be to get this all into the right context.
Right. Thank you, Sonia. A lot of known unknowns and unknown unknowns then for investors over the coming months. Well, Emil, emerging market equities continue to underperform in aggregate, with China a major factor. What needs to happen for a turnaround?
Yeah, over the past decade, sort of China contributed about 35% of GDP growth, while the US accounted for on 27% of GDP growth. So whatever happens in China is very important for what happens in the rest of emerging markets. And there's a lot of negative sentiment in China. China had markets had a terrible 2023. That obviously doesn't help sentiment, but there's also limited, disappointing policy support from the government, tensions with the West, and market unfriendly regulations in China as well. The Chinese housing sector is the biggest issue. There's excessive ownership. We think it's about two times as much ownership, housing ownership as normal in comparable to peers, the emerging market peers, and excessive building activity as well. The Chinese leaders have a big challenge because they want to wean off the country of excessive credit, and the reliance on the real estate sector needs to stop. But that brings with it financial risks as well. And then what you normally is necessary for that is a sort of slow burning balance sheet like recession, where slowly but gradually the markets and the economy is weaned off of those excesses. But that, as I said, that brings financial risks as well. We expect increasingly negative rhetorics towards China, driven by political sensitivity in the US, but also the rest of the world, and increasingly tension focus on tariffs and what's going to happen there. So we think what's needed for a turnaround in China, our China guru Eric Lloyd believes that it takes an additional 2 years if you don't do additional stimulus to sort of in a natural way resolve the housing market over capacity. And perhaps surprisingly, given the negative sentiment, and we like areas of negative sentiment and lean against that, surprisingly, we don't think Chinese equities are a big buying opportunity at the moment. They're not super cheap. Earnings have also gone down, so valuations haven't gone really, really cheap. And we don't think there is a big stimulus of the government coming, because that fits sort of the policy of slowly managing themselves out of the crisis. If you then look at other emerging markets, then, yeah, as I said, it's very dependent on what's happening in China and what's happening in global financial conditions. And there we see risks as well. So it's not that straightforward to say, well, given the underperformance, it's now the time to sort of start piling into emerging market as a sector. We also have seen quite a lot of country-specific risk coming up in the previous years. Think about what's happening in Argentina. Think what's happening in Russia. If you sort of buy emerging market as an asset class, you're exposed to these ones. So what you have to do is look at idiosyncratic stories, which are really attractive. And we think Indian local bond market is a strong example of that. It has great fundamentals. So our EM economist, Eric, loves that. It has low volatility, and it has a tailwind of the index inclusion by, for instance, JP Morgan. We think that JP Morgan inclusion drives about 20 to 30 billion of extra liquidity into that market, which you would see as a reason for spreads versus other comparable markets to contract. So we think that is a really interesting opportunity to play in emerging markets.
Okay, thanks, Emil. It's a good example of the importance of being selective in exposure there too. Tim, returning to the, I suppose, one of the key themes of the call, do you think the experience of the last few years will trigger meaningful long-term changes in how central bankers and economists forecast inflation?
So, Max, remember, when policymakers and economists stand up publicly and make accurate forecasts, it's down to our enormous skill.
Right.
When the forecasts go wrong, it's just bad luck. Now, joking aside, privately, there is a bit more humility, but probably not quite enough. Mm. And turning to the inflation, you'd think that with all the data and computing power, we'd be getting better at the forecasting, but there's not much evidence that is occurring. In terms of the lessons from the pandemic, I think a lot of the models are calibrated mainly on trying to forecast changes in demand, what it does to output gaps and unemployment and wages. Perhaps there wasn't enough emphasis on the supply side. We saw enormous swings in the supply side, which really had an outsized impact on inflation. So going forward, I think the models will be kind of tweaked here and there, but you know, don't bank on economists becoming much better at forecasting in the future than we have failed miserably in the past.
Okay, because that in itself is another forecast. So we'll just have to see how that one pans out. Thank you, Tim. Sonia, we've covered a vast amount of ground today, as we always do. What are the key takeaways for investors?
I think if you consider everything we've said, it's very clear that diversification will matter a lot more going forward than it has in the past. We have been, and obviously we have to discount the last 4 years with the extraordinary backdrop of pandemic and geopolitical tensions. But if you consider the period before, it's been an extraordinary period of rising asset prices across the board, where investors enjoyed really a Goldilocks setup of very supportive central banks and really a benign global backdrop. We have said throughout the call that we believe this is going to change, and hence diversification being a far more core ingredient in being successful in markets. We've talked a lot about valuations, and I think we've agreed across all three of us. Valuations are not a good short-term indicator on where markets are heading, and I think Emil was very clear. Even if we're approaching quite lofty valuations, there's nothing, you know, currently demonstrating that this will come to an end immediately. What valuations are good at is telling you how medium to long term return expectations will pan out. That is the important takeaway. And hence looking for uncorrelated return profiles. This is why Emil has mentioned Indian local bonds, right? You're looking for a diversification of opportunities that clearly are still there. Mm-hmm. But we have to take a step back and acknowledge that what we're currently witnessing is a shift in the market backdrop. We've talked a lot about inflation, but in combination, obviously, with the shift that has happened in fixed income markets and interest rates, alongside the political and geopolitical position that we are witnessing and that still is in flux and will changing more, it is about understanding those opportunities and the diversification impact and the improvement in risk return profiles you can achieve if you are focusing on a well-diversified portfolio.
Well, thanks very much for that overview, Sonia. Finally, to everyone here, as we always end these calls, I'd just like to ask what you've been watching, reading or listening to recently. I'll get the ball rolling and say I've been reading Get Shorty by Elmore Leonard, which is a 80s book about Hollywood and the mafia. It was a 1990s film as well, and it's a lot of fun. Emil, over to you.
Oh, my book tip is a depressing one in a way. I have been reading How Democracies Die from Stephen Levitsky and at least one other academic whose name I don't remember. But they sort of examine, they're obviously experts in what happened in history, and they examine signposts for trends where democracies get in danger and actually end up in dictatorships. And reading through the book, even though it's focusing on what happened in previous occasions, yeah, you cannot sort of stop drawing parallels of what's happening at the moment in many Western worlds. And yeah, that yeah, has a profound impact of or in the coming decade of how the society will develop itself.
Good. Thank you, Sonia.
I have been reading a very interesting book as well, not quite as depressing. It's by Professor Steve Peters, and it's called The Chimp Paradox. It's the mind management. It's fabulous. It explains in very clear terms how the brain works and how very often we can understand how we react in specific circumstances, how we react to others because of the different functions within the brain. Absolutely fascinating and actually incredibly relevant, I felt, in the context of stakeholder management.
Great. It does sound a very, very useful read. Tim?
I've read that book and my wife reminds me not to trigger her chimp. In terms of what I'm reading, so I'm related to the potential for an artificial intelligence bubble that Emil talked about. I'm absorbing everything I can on this topic, try and understand what the real world impact could be. Most economists, I think, see it as something which will augment workers and a much needed boost to productivity. But then there is an alternative school of thought suggesting this could be highly disruptive. There's nothing like anything we've seen before. Economists just don't get it. And then if we do see disruption in labour, particularly as it will be knowledge workers and they're politically active, that could have major repercussions for politics and global conflicts. And when I try and switch off from all of this, I'm slowly working my way through Ted Lasso.
Oh, right. Of course. Apple TV. Yeah. Great. Well, a great eclectic bunch of recommendations for our listeners, as ever. Thank you all. And that's a great point on which to end this month's call. Thank you, Sonia, Tim and Emil, for your time today. And thank you to you, our clients and listeners, for joining us. You can find our latest updates on our social media channels, on the Elgin blog, and of course here on Elgin Talks. The next edition of this podcast will be in late May, when Sonia will be joined by Madeline King and Howie Lee to discuss key findings of our CIO spring update.
As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals only and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of the recording and do not reflect the views of legal and general investment management. Forward-looking statements are, by their nature, subject to significant risks and uncertainties and are based on internal forecasts and assumptions and should not be relied upon. Where individual stocks are mentioned, these do not constitute a recommendation to buy or sell any security and are for illustrative purposes only. Legal & General Investment Management Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. To find more content, you can check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website. Copyright 2023. Legal & General Investment Management Limited. All rights reserved. No part of this publication may be reproduced or transmitted in any form or by any means, including photocopying and recording, without the written permission of the publishers. This material is issued by Legal & General Investment Management Asia Limited, the licensed corporation BBB 488, regulated by the Hong Kong Securities and Futures Commission, for professional investors only.